Your Honor. Good morning.
Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 55284, Foster v. Costco. Mr. Sterling for the appellant, Ms. Nelson for the respondent. Mr. Sterling, we're ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're here today, I assume, to take a look at the open and obvious danger rule, a concept in Nevada law anyway that goes back to the gun lock case over 50 years ago, and that is still causing consternation and confusion among attorneys and the judges and the district courts, apparently. We certainly argue in this case that the judge didn't reach the right decision in granting summary judgment against my client, Mr. Foster, on the grounds that the danger was open and obvious in this case. I've laid it out in quite a bit of detail in my opening brief, but it bears note that the law has changed quite a bit in the days since Gunlock, and that statement in Gunlock that a possessor of property is not liable for injury to an invitee resulting from a danger that is open and obvious. That is simply not an accurate statement at this time, and I think the court, or I direct the court's attention in particular to the Sciuffi case, the Harrington versus Sciuffi case. That's the tire spikes case, where this court said that the open and obvious danger rule only applies to the failure to warn part of a negligence case and doesn't have any application other than that. A property owner is still liable or still can be liable in negligence for negligently directing somebody to the danger or creating the danger. Now, before I get into too much detail about the law in this case and creating a framework for the way I think these should be analyzed, I want to look at the specific facts of this case because I think that it can be resolved fairly simply on the grounds that there really is a question of fact in this case as to whether the danger was open and obvious. In this case, Mr. Foster tripped over the corner of a pallet in the aisle of Costco in Henderson. He acknowledges that he was aware of the pallets. However, at the time, the Costco employee was loading or unloading pallets or moving product around in the aisle. There were several pallets on each side of the aisle that were encroaching out into the aisleway. There was no barricade or any warning provided, and shoppers were shopping in that aisle, including my client. He says, as I mentioned, that he was aware of the pallets, but he didn't see the corner of one of the pallets that was protruding under or behind a box. That in itself creates a jury question as to whether the danger was open or obvious for the purpose of requiring a warning or also under the general negligence analysis. So first of all, we've argued that reversal of the summary judgment is warranted on that grounds.
Would we have to overrule Gunlock, or would we have to clarify Gunlock, modify Gunlock, if we were writing to support your position?
I think the court needs to clarify Gunlock. I think the court needs to clarify Harrington versus Sciuffi, and the court needs to bring in Turner versus Mandalay Bay and the ruling that the court made in that case with regard to implied assumption of risk, and bring all those into harmony, which is not difficult to do if you read each of those cases. It's really laid out already for the court. In Harrington versus Sciuffi, when the court said that the open and obvious danger rule only obviates the duty to warn, I think that's accurate, but it's misleading because obviously the concept of an open and obvious danger is also relevant to a general duty analysis. Excuse me. And I think this is a big area where the confusion is judges and attorneys, all of us it's common for each of us to say that danger is open and obvious, so there's no negligence. And that makes sense. Buildings have walls, buildings have doors, buildings have furniture, tables. Obviously, possessor of land doesn't have to argue, doesn't have to warn with regard to all of those kind of inherent dangers. So, and we'd also say not only do you not have to warn, but that the property owner is not negligent, because those kind of dangers are open and obvious. So in that sense, we're using open and obvious really as a statement of the conclusion that there's no negligence. That kind of analysis would seem to run contrary to what was stated in Harrington versus Sciuffi, which is that the open and obvious danger rule only relates to failure to warn. Now, when we're looking at that second prong of Harrington versus Sciuffi, which is whether the property owner is negligent for creating the peril or exposing the invitee to the peril, I think it's important to look at some of the subsequent cases to Gunlock. If we look at, in particular, Rogers versus Torre, this is the case where the plaintiff slipped and fell on ice in the parking lot. And what this court said is that that created a question of fact as to whether there could be negligence, even if she was aware of the ice, because the question really came down to whether or not the property owner had to do something about that danger, even if it was open and obvious. And that case relied on Restatement Section 743 and 743A, which I have attached to the briefs as an addendum, and also which I've discussed in detail. And I think the restatement provides a good framework that would clarify Gunlock, which is you can't just say, as was argued in the summary judgment motion here, that if it's open and obvious, there's no negligence and there's no liability. You've got to conduct the full analysis.
Well, but Rogers versus Torre, Justice Thompson makes an effort to distinguish Gunlock, and it's focusing on the foreseeability that the plaintiff would be forced to encounter that open and obvious danger, and whether by precautions the danger could have been obviated or an alternate route provided. How does that apply to this case? I mean, under Roger versus Torre, what does the record show with respect to this person's navigating the aisle of the store where these pallets and boxes were located? I mean, they were visible, clearly. He admits he saw them. I'm just a little bit pressed. Would you have us also distinguish the Torre case?
No, I think the Torre case is really on all fours with our fact pattern here. In the Torre case, the plaintiff was directed or had
going
to navigate
work.
Had to navigate the peril, even though she was aware of it, because she needed to get to work, is what the court said.
And they did precautions on the sidewalk, but not the parking lot. So there were available precautions. There was some showing that there was a duty and a feasibility of obviating the risk.
Right. I don't see Torre as a failure to warn case per se, because it's acknowledged that the plaintiff was aware of the peril. So the question was, can the property owner still be negligent even though the danger was, in that sense, open and obvious? And that's where I think that the case...
What's the negligence here?
The negligence here is allowing the pallets to encroach into the aisle at the same time that they're being unloaded and loaded without barricading off that aisle. The negligence is that even though, and the client here testified to this, he was aware of the pallets, he was still shopping, so he was trying to be careful, navigate around the pallets, and he was injured by tripping over them. Just as the plaintiff in Torre tried to navigate the peril in the parking lot. I don't want to concede that the danger in our case is open and obvious, because I think there is a fact question there, too. But even if we say it is, there's still negligence on the part of Costco for not cordoning off that area, providing additional warnings for people while they're shopping, being distracted by looking for things, being distracted by the employee that's loading and unloading, that sort of thing. So I think that case is on all fours of our case. So what we really need to do, if we look at Torre or if we look at the restatement, is when we get to that second prong under Harrington versus Sciuffi and analyze first the negligence or alleged negligence of the property owner, we need to say, is this a peril that the property owner should have anticipated that customers will encounter or try to navigate? If so, were the precautions taken by the property owner in response to that reasonable? And that's a jury question, and I think that's where we are in this case. And I brought up the baseball rule case, the Turner versus the ballpark case out here, Mandalay Resort. I brought that up because that case made it clear that in spite of Ms. Ashumi, am I saying that right? I don't think I have that pronounced correctly. But in spite of the earlier decision of this court that all implied negligence was subsumed by comparative negligence, in spite of that prior ruling, this court in Turner overruled the part as to primary, as to second, I'm sorry, let me back up a little bit. In Turner, what this court said is that primary implied assumption of the risk, which is where the plaintiff impliedly assumes the risk of dangers that are inherent in a particular activity, that survives comparative negligence. So I want to get back to when I said earlier that attorneys talk about open and obvious being a catchphrase or a conclusion for no negligence. I think we're really talking about that kind of situation, primary implied assumption of the risk, where we say furniture, tables, chairs, doors, walls, that sort of things are risks in a building, but we're never going to say that that will result in liability because they're open and obvious. In essence, that an invitee assumes the risk of those kinds of dangers. But when we're talking about secondary implied assumption of the risk, which is whether or not the property owner, I mean, whether or not the invitee assumed the risk of the negligence of the property owner, that's a jury question that is subsumed within comparative negligence, as this court said in Ms. Ashumi, or whatever the name of that case is, I apologize.
So, Mr. Sterling, yes. Your argument in this case is liability rests on two grounds. One, that the open and obvious nature of this condition is a question of fact, and that alternatively, Costco's negligent for failing to barricade around the pallet area.
That's correct, Your Honor. And to the extent that Costco argues that my client was negligent or should have seen the risk or not encountered it, those are all subsumed within the comparative negligence analysis.
And the basis of the second argument is the reasoning in Roger?
And the reasoning in Roger, and also as affected by this court in Turner and subsequent cases, which made clear that that secondary implied assumption of the risk doctrine survives or doesn't survive the comparative negligence statute. I have a little bit of time left. I'm going to reserve that if I may.
Thank you. Ms. Nelson.
Good morning. Sharon Nelson on behalf of Costco. I would like to kind of track how opposing counsel presented to you and start with the open and obvious issue. Obviously, our position is the evidence does support this was open and obvious, and the record fully supports that as well. This is an individual who testified in his deposition that on the date of the incident, before he entered the aisle, he saw a number of pallets both on the right-hand side of the aisle and the left-hand side of the aisle. He was so observant as he entered that aisle that he was able to detail the number of pallets on the right-hand side versus the number of pallets on the left-hand side. He also testified in his deposition that at the time that he approached the pallet, that he saw someone removing merchandise from the pallet, and that boxes covered the bottom portion of the pallet. He fully admitted during his deposition that he saw that it was a pallet. He saw it was square because there was a square pile of boxes on the pallet. He saw wood between the boxes on the pallet, and he presumed it was a pallet. And all of that was prior to his impact with the pallet. So those things certainly indicate that the pallet was open and obvious to him. And in fact, what was argued at the lower court level, in one respect, was that it wasn't that the pallet wasn't observed, it was that the corner of a pallet was not observed, which is how we got into kind of this obscured or partial showing of the pallet and the discussion under Gunlock and whether or not something that's partially concealed can still be open and obvious. This is not a situation where this particular individual was not aware of the pallet, of the shape of the pallet, that it existed and where it was placed prior to impacting it. And certainly, this is not a Rogers case at all. There was no compulsion on the part of this particular plaintiff, nothing that required him, after he observed pallets and after he indicated he knew both the size of the pallet, the location of the pallet, what was on the pallet, and what was being done with the pallet. There was no evidence set forth at the lower court record that he was nonetheless required to take that route, go down that aisle, and to try to navigate around the pallet. It certainly falls in line, Justice Pickering, with your question about isn't this different, because what is the compulsion? And that's what we argued at the lower court level, is there's no compulsion here. This is not an individual that has to go to work and thus has to traverse a parking lot that's icy. It's just not a compulsion situation at all. So with respect to the evidence that was presented at the lower court level regarding the open and obvious nature of the condition, we certainly believe that evidence was sufficient and the lower court's ruling was proper in granting summary judgment with respect to the failure to warn as to the open and obvious condition of the pallet. The second prong and the second argument...
The compulsion that he was asserting is that he wanted the trash bags that were only available by navigating the aisle with the pallets, correct?
That's the compulsion he asserted in his affidavit filed after his deposition was taken, yes. And I absolutely disagree that that is a compulsion similar to requiring an employee to be present at work. He could have asked the stock person that he saw right there unloading things to hand him the trash bags. He could have asked other Costco personnel to hand him the trash bags. He could have gone around the area entirely, gone to the front, asked someone to hand him the trash bags. There was no evidence presented by Mr. Foster or his attorneys at the lower court level that would lead either the lower court level to determine or this court level or this court to ascertain that he was forced to get those trash bags himself. And because of that, it completely differs from the Rogers case. The second argument posited by you or to you this morning was that there was a failure on the part of Costco to barricade. And the problem with that argument is the representations and admissions that were made in the record at the lower court level. At the time of oral argument, plaintiff's counsel said, and this is at Appendix 90, lines 21 through 22, the pallet is not the danger. The pallet is not the peril. That was consistent with the moving papers that were filed at the lower court level by plaintiff's counsel, and that's at Appendix 37, lines 21 through 22, where they again say a 4 feet by 4 feet pallet on the side of an aisle is not inherently dangerous. That is a recognition at the lower court level on the part of the plaintiff himself that this is not a situation where Costco had any duty to barricade because, in fact, that admission indicates the pallet was not posing a danger. So literally what they're asking this court to do is clarify Gunlock on facts that don't support clarification and hold an entity responsible for not warning because there was a box on the corner of a pallet which they say didn't present any harm to the person at that location. And the record does not support, nor does the law support, that kind of determination from this court.
What are the differences, if any, between the argument your opponent is making on appeal and the argument he presented in the district court opposing summary judgment? More precisely, what was the theory of negligence articulated in the district court, the duty and its breach? Was it failure to warn? Or was it failure to put up barricades, or was it something else, all of the above?
It was both. With respect to the failure to warn argument, the argument posited at the lower court level was that not that the pallets were not open and obvious, because obviously there was a concession on the part of the plaintiff that he had seen the pallets, but that a box partially obscured the corner of the pallet. And that box obscuring the corner of the pallet then made that particular corner on which the plaintiff tripped not open and obvious. So that was the argument with respect to the open and obvious condition. With respect to maintaining premises in a reasonably safe condition, the argument again was made that there was some sort of duty to warn, to encourage customers not to go down the aisle, either on the part of the stock person who was there, or either through barricading that aisle or posting another member of Costco there to warn people not to go down the aisle. But those arguments were intertwined with the admissions, the pallet isn't creating any harm, the pallet is not a danger, the pallet is not the peril, which made that argument, I believe, somewhat difficult for the district court to find in favor of the plaintiff on, given those admissions. I don't know if this court wants me to discuss the assumption of the risk and the primary...
So your position, Ms. Nelson, is that it wouldn't have been necessary to put up orange cones to protect a box on the corner of a pallet?
No, Your Honor. And it would have been necessary, I believe, if there had been a box in and of itself sitting on the floor to provide some sort of warning or notification of that, because depending on the size of the box, that may not be open and obvious. But when you're in a warehouse situation where a merchandiser routinely uses pallets that this particular plaintiff said he had witnessed on a number of occasions prior to this incident, and you have pallets that are of a standard size, the record shows they were 4x4, and you have pallets both on the right-hand side of the aisle and the left-hand side of the aisle, and then a box sitting on top of that. No, it is, the law certainly does not require that there be a cone in front of that pallet to show that there's a box that could cause harm. It is our position, and it has been briefed in our papers, that we believe that this is, if the court is going to delve into an assumption of the risk analysis, that this falls into primary versus secondary. With respect to an assumption of the risk, this is incidental to the shopping experience, and that is based on the lower court record as well. Mr. Foster submitted an affidavit in support of his opposition to summary judgment after his deposition, in which he said he shopped at this particular location every 2 to 3 months. He, during his deposition, indicated that in shopping at that location prior to the incident, had seen the pallets a number of occasions, and he described them as 4x4 standard wooden pallets. When asked during his deposition if he'd ever seen a pallet that was not square in nature at the location, meaning that a corner had been rounded, he said no, they were always square. And those admissions are important because when you're talking about the primary assumption of the risk, we have to show that he assumed that it was a well-known situation to him and that it was incidental to his shopping experience. And all of those facts go to support that. This is no different than the Turner situation, where baseballs and foul balls at a sporting incident are common and accepted. When you're going to a warehouse shopping situation where you know that the merchandiser, and you know from prior experience the merchandiser displays products by using pallets, incidental to your shopping experience is going to be a pallet there, maybe more than one pallet, and in this situation there were more than one. So for all of the reasons that we've put forth in the papers and we've discussed here today, we believe that the lower court's decision was absolutely accurate, and we ask that you affirm it in all respects.
Any further questions, Justice Pickering, Justice Horsley?
Thank you,
Ms. Nelson. Mr. Sterling, your rebuttal.
To again address Justice Pickering's question briefly, the compulsion question here is a jury question, so it's an issue of whether the compulsion for the based on shopping is sufficient, needs to be sent back down for a jury trial, not to be decided on summary judgment. With regard to primary versus secondary, our argument here is that we're in the secondary implied assumption of risk category. If the client, the plaintiff had just run into the aisle or run into a door or run into pallets that were underneath the shelving, we wouldn't be here today. I think that would fall under primary. That's an inherent risk of the warehouse shopping. But to move the pallets down into the aisle and have them being loaded and unloaded while customers are shopping, I don't think that's an inherent risk. I think that's a jury question. Falls under the secondary implied assumption of the risk. With regard to gun lock, just to make my position clear, I think gun lock's an oversimplification in the way that it's used by many attorneys and judges, which is if something's open and obvious, there's no negligence and there's no liability. That's not the law that this court has developed over the years in the cases we've been talking about and that are cited in the briefs. And again, with regard to the question of he saw the pallets, we've made a distinction, and we've also appended to our brief the Loudermilk federal case, the distinction between seeing the pallet and seeing, which is sort of...
Finish your thought. Go ahead.
As distinguished from the actual peril itself, the instrumentality, which is the hidden corner of the pallet. And that's a distinction that's made in the Loudermilk case. It's also a distinction that's made in comment B of the restatement section. And I would just refer to the court to footnote 9, page 19 of the opening brief on that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sterling. Thank you, Ms. Nelson, for your arguments in this matter and for the briefs. This matter will stand submitted.